welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. My name is Chris and I'm joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host Tom.
Hello.
And we just finished watching Jean-Pierre Melville's 1956 film, Bob Le Flambeur.
Well said.
Yeah, I feel it. I can't help but pronounce it like that.
Well enunciated. Le Flambeur. So, yeah, we'll do a synopsis.
Yeah.
The film is about Bob the gambler. Gambling extraordinaire, and ex-con, ex-bank robber. It follows him through his later, old-ish age, just kicking around doing gambling, and he gets a tip-off that there is $800 million locked in a safe in a bank.
A casino.
In a casino. Yes.
I keep interjecting.
Well, I was false. And the story just follows him essentially organizing a heist.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of twists and turns and setups and payoffs and stuff like that.
Presented in wonderful film noir style.
Mm.
Yeah. So you'd never seen any Jean-Pierre Melville before this one, I'm guessing.
I don't think so.
Yeah. I've seen a couple of his films and I'm a big fan. Le Samurai, I think, is an awesome, awesome movie. It's about a hitman who's kind of on the run and has been double-crossed. The Le Cherchez Rouge, which is also a kind of heisty kind of...
Are they also in the collection?
Yes, they are. He has about five or six movies in the collection.
Okay.
And this is the first one we've encountered. Yeah, he's a very well-known French crime director. And this one kind of stands out because this was his first foray into the... crime and heist genre, a genre that he then went on to pretty much define as a modern director.
I could see why. I mean, like, you can definitely see, like, the later heist films, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned that Ocean's 11 draws a lot of inspiration
from this. Yeah, doing a little bit of research, it was said that this heavily influenced the 1970s Ocean's 11, and then, obviously, later, the remake that came.
Mm.
I suppose in the elements of casino heist and having to get, you know, someone who works at the casino, like, on board, like, all the different, the hiring of the gang and all of that stuff. Even though in this film we don't necessarily get backstories or information on anyone apart from maybe two or three people in the gang. It's not about them, it's about Bob. The movie's about Bob. So,
yeah. Well, and also his kind of protege, Paulo.
Yep.
Who's the son of... one of Bob's ex-colleagues.
Yeah.
Who I suppose was killed.
Yeah, he was killed in the bank robbery that Bob got arrested for 20 years ago. So
okay.
I think he feels a responsibility to, at first, keep Paulo out of trouble. And then also, once he kind of gets his heart set on doing this job, having him in... I mean, Paulo shows that he wants to partake in a life of crime. And so... I think he kind of... Bob resigns himself to, like, oh, he's going to do it. I'll do it with him so I can look out for him and all of that. And it, you know.
Yeah, he seems to think that it's a romantic thing.
Yeah,
like, I guess, like, if your father's been killed,
yeah,
you will probably dwell on that enough to think that the good parts about his dad's life would be really magical.
Yes, yeah.
Even though it's highly fucking risky.
Yeah, and the fact that he's hearing all these old war stories and stuff from Bob, his old partner and stuff, like, yeah...
So there are a few side characters.
Yeah.
But generally about Bob.
Mm. Before we get into the movie, I kind of just want to jump back to Melville himself, and I kind of mentioned before that this influenced a lot of crime and heist films that came after it. I think it's such an interesting fact that this one was 1956, and it's going for that kind of noir style, so it's very heavily influenced by the films of, like, John Huston and things back, like, the American film noirs of the 30s and 40s.
Mm.
And then he's taken, clearly a fan of those type of films, has made his own that has then gone on to influence the genre, like, because he's kind of influenced from a genre, he wants to do that genre, but then the film he makes then kind of continues to influence...
Yeah.
And change and evolve that genre.
It redefines it.
Yeah, I find that super interesting when that happens.
Oh, it's good. Good for him.
Yeah.
But, I mean, yeah, right. So, why don't we talk about a heist movies in general and where they came from, where they were going.
I reckon. Because we had a few in the collection. None as memorable as this, I don't think. I mean, this was my first watching, and we only just finished it, but I feel this one's going to kind of linger with me more than some of the other ones we've had.
There was one, I forget the name now, maybe you can help me out.
It was right, I want to say Latrell, but I know that's the Prison Break movie.
Yeah, no,
but
it was another one.
It was right around that time when we were doing that. I'm gonna look it up.
It's a film that contains like a 30 minute silent movie heist.
Rafifi,
that's the one. But yes, it's brilliant, kind of dissimilar to this in that it lets you experience the heist without really knowing where they're going with it.
Yeah.
Whereas this one is definitely like, defined the heist movie as, set up your characters, they go forward into a heist, and then you get to learn how the heist works and then see if they can pull it off.
To the extent
which
that,
is literally Ocean's 11.
Yeah. And even to the extent that the heist is not even mentioned, or like, no real crime is mentioned within the film until about the 40-minute mark. Up until that point, you kind of assume you're being given a straight character piece.
Mm.
You're introduced to Bob, who, right off the bat, you find interest. Like, he's got a real interesting opening and, like, intrigue about him. And then you start to glean information from other characters talking about him. He himself never spouts what he's talking about. Like, or, you know, his backstory. You just hear it from... You piece together his story, and then you enter the young girl and things, and it's you think you're just going to watch, oh, it's this old man, former criminal character piece.
Yeah, but then, the first 40 minutes.
And then it slowly evolves into a heist film.
Yeah.
Whereas I think modern day heist films, for the most part, I think are just, nope, we need to get down to the nitty gritty. This is what we're doing. This is...
There's the setup, then there's the roll call, then there is the... finding out the systems to break in.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Like, I mean, even Ocean's 11. I mean, I'm going to go off of the 2001 Soderbergh movie, not the old 70s one with Frank Sinatra, just because I've seen the Soderbergh one more.
Mm-hmm.
It's... That film, he gets out of prison, and he goes and meets Brad Pitt, and then immediately it's like, I want to do a heist. Like, it's immediate. Like, there's no time to, like, build and establish characters. The characters get established and built while the planning of the heist happens.
That one, I think its approach is very kind of rock star-y.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Like, a lot of the characters, it's like, it's designed to give you the impression that it's really glamorous.
It's a very cool movie. Yeah. Like, it's just, yeah.
I mean, and, you know, it works with a heist movie. It is kind of cool, even though illegal.
Yes.
But, yeah, this was... not really doing that at all.
Yeah.
Which
is why I think it's an interesting film, and why I think it's called Bob the Gambler, as opposed to, you know, Casino Heist, the movie.
Yeah.
Like,
because
it is a film that is about Bob, and it is a... Even though a heist happens, I still feel is a character piece. Because that's what kind of... the film even ends on, and it's like what ends up being somewhat their downfall to some degree. It's his compulsions as a character get the best of him, and he...
You're right. I mean, I think it boils down to let's figure out what Bob's nature is.
Yeah.
And the narrative flows directly from that. The ending of the movie is a study in Bob's nature.
Yes.
And it completely, you know... The fact that he is the way he is completely changes the ending to what you thought was going to happen.
Yeah.
Does a complete twist.
Mm. How do you think this... I don't want to do the ranking aspect of, like, how this stacks up against heist films, but, like, what are some... I kind of want to keep on the note of heist films for a little bit. What are some other kind of key ones you think that, like, that come to mind? Are there any that...
Any heist movies that I enjoy?
Yeah.
The Sting? Okay, I really love The Sting.
Yeah.
That's also kind of romanticizing the heist as well.
Yeah.
It's kind of... I guess it would be in between Ocean's 11 and this film, if you want. But I guess what you're trying to ask me is what makes a good heist movie?
Yes.
Right? Well, certainly we all want a little bit of the romantic notion of you know, being the successful heister.
Yeah.
But naturally, it's going to be exciting, and that's what I want out of a heist movie.
Mm.
This film doesn't give you the excitement till, like, really the third act. It's the first act I found was actually quite slow.
Yeah.
Maybe too slow.
Yeah, I think in the first act in particular, it's leaning towards the noir more than it is the heist elements of the genre.
Although it was, I did appreciate a lot of the slow plotting nature of setups.
Yeah.
And sometimes it was there was obvious setups, and sometimes there was kind of subtle setups. Stuff like the they've got to pay 500 franc for the plans to the casino.
Yeah.
To some fellow that can get the plans.
Yeah, the croupier dealer. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Yeah. And obviously he buys a watch, a really nice watch for his wife, and his wife kind of plants the seed of, like, oh, how'd you pay for that?
Yeah.
That kind of shit is great.
Yes.
Because you know there's set up, it kind of...
It starts planting the seeds of doubt that the heist can be pulled off.
Which adds, like, so much tension.
Yes.
Because you're starting to see...
The, like, cracks.
like a steam train just fucking wrecking, you know.
Yeah. It's up until like that point, really, we're presented just... Like, we're never privy to anyone that works at the casino, anyone that's going to be affected by the heist. Only the people that are going to perpetrate it and how it's going to better them. Mm. So we're just like, cool, this is going to be great.
Yeah.
It's going to be wonderful.
Yeah.
And then you, with the introduction of the wife kind of doubting and, like, kind of being like, oh, what's up? You just get the first seed of, oh, this could go all wrong.
Yeah, yeah. And again, I thought another great setup. I mean, I just really appreciate it when a film takes its time to set something up. And so when you have Bob at the start of the film being woken up in the middle of the night, and a man comes to the door, Mark, who says, I need help.
Yeah.
And I need, you know, X amount of money. Help me out. And the dude, and Bob's like, no, fucking, you're not going to get any cash because you're a fucking pimp and you hit women.
Yeah, he's a pimp and he needs the money because he beat a girl so bad she's in the hospital.
Mm.
So Bob's like, get the fuck out of my apartment, you piece of shit.
Yeah, and so naturally when Mark gets fucked for some crime.
For being a sidewalk Romeo, that awesome,
a sidewalk Romeo.
Awesome term for a pimp.
Yeah. So it's all set up. Of course he's going to put this erroneous figure out into the casino's vault.
Yeah.
Just to get back at Bob. And so the whole time he's shooting for nothing.
Yeah.
And so right there you it's kind of planting the seeds that it's a luck game as opposed to a,
which all draws back into the whole basis of Bob as a character. It's the nature of gambling and pulling off this heist. It's a gamble, and it's what the compulsion that drives him to do it. And I think it's like the whole heist is just purely based on chance. And
yeah,
that's what drives that man.
It's such an interesting concept for a heist film when you set it up that way, that you know, the characters obviously don't know, but when you know that it's all for nothing,
yeah,
and shit starts to go wrong,
yes,
then you start to pick up, like, maybe there's silver lining to, you know, horrible shit that happens to the main character.
Yeah.
It's a good thing now, so that doesn't often happen in a film.
Yeah. As well, I suppose, the other narrative thing that I really, really enjoyed about this film was the... I assumed it was the beginning of the third act, or like the end of the second act into the third act, where once you have the couple, the wife of the croupier, kind of decide, no, we're gonna break this all down, like what's going on here, and then also God, I'm blanking on the Anne, and the young girl who Paulo is having a relationship with somewhat tells Mark about the heist and it all. He's going to go tell the cops. And you have this idea that, oh God, so we've gone through an entire heist film that is the setup of a heist film where the heist is never actually going to happen.
Mm.
That's where my mind went to where this was going. And I was like, that is fucking a brilliant and original way to present a heist film.
Yeah, I mean, I think like 15 or 20 minutes from the end of the film, it really makes you think that There's no heist at all.
Yeah, it's going to be a heist film without a heist, which, I mean, would give you somewhat, like, for lack of a better term, like, blue balls at the end of this film. Like, you just, like,
I guess
see that heist, but it never fucking happened.
Yeah.
But
isn't that tension moment, isn't it? Because the exciting part is them cracking the safe.
Yes.
On the job.
Yeah.
That's what, that's what everyone's going, like, oh, that's going to be just the most amazing part of the movie.
Yeah, but then seeing, like, for a thread come out of the sweater and just it start to get pulled and pulled and pulled and unraveled, you're just, like, that puts you on the edge of your seat, like, this fucking sweater's going to come apart. What's happening?
They're going to be so cold.
I know. What's going to happen to these guys without a jumper on?
It's a fine trade-off.
Yeah.
It's a fine trade-off.
And then, you know, what we actually get presented in the film, I think, is a more satisfying...
But then it does another twist at the end as well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there are three or four different narrative twists that happen in the space of about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
That it's... Instead of presenting a heist, it keeps throwing curveballs at you to keep you on the edge of your seat, as opposed to the heist to keep you on the edge of your seat.
I know, it's such an interesting way to do it.
Yeah.
And of course, the film starts off with a character study on Bob, and then finishes with, it's like seemingly no character arc at all.
Yeah.
Where he just decides to gamble the evening away.
Yes.
Thereby, I mean, I thought that he was going to walk away with having
the guys outside.
Kind of stolen from the casino and gone, well, we heisted him, I guess.
Yeah, and it's the whole idea of he didn't need to resort back to the life of crime, and he didn't need to drag Paula and all these people into it. Instead, he managed to do it his own way, which was gambling. But he unfortunately is so caught up in gambling that it just kind of doesn't get to that point.
Yeah. But
which is that, like, an indictment on... Well, not necessarily an indictment, but, like, a statement about him and his vice, I guess. Is that what this film's... Because I don't think the film is necessarily trying to push an agenda or, like, say anything negative, especially about Bob, but...
This is almost like
it ends up being... It's his defining thing, but it's also the downfall of these men.
Yeah, I think it's almost like an abstract popcorn film.
Yeah.
Where it's... You know, Ocean's 11's popcorn film.
Yes.
You go there and you just... no one's looking for a message.
No.
You just go in there to feel excitement and fun and stuff like that.
Which is why I enjoy the Melville films that I have seen, because they are supreme popcorn films, but presented in an almost French New Wave style, which is like these kind of... Because the problem I have with a lot of the French New Wave stuff is you're left at the end of it going like, cool, what?
Yeah.
What was I... Like, you're left having to dissect, and you're constantly, while watching it, analysing and dissecting and trying to kind of pass the meaning of what is going on here. Whereas with Melville, he's presenting it in that kind of French New Wave style, but he's just like, man, this is just fun.
Yeah, just have a good time.
Just have a good time.
Yeah. Which is great.
Mm. Which is kind of interesting. Apparently this film is one of the precursors to French New Wave. This was kind of the impetus that then brought on this entire movement.
I thought French New Wave was like pre-50s.
No, 60s. French New Wave was like Godard and Truffaut and stuff. Like, okay. I think like what was defined as like one of the first French New Wave was like 400 Blows.
Oh yeah.
Which was 59. So yeah. 3 years after this. So yeah, apparently what kind of prompted it was like the somewhat disjointed nature that we get presented in this film, like the jump cuts and things, as well as the handheld photography.
Oh yeah,
that was apparently what inspired.
I don't know if I really liked a lot of the cuts in it.
Yeah,
it was really choppy.
It
was like some of it felt really unnecessary. Almost there's cuts, like, it's hard to explain over a podcast, but there'd be cuts of people driving, and rather than just show like one shot, it would just it'll just jump to another shot that's a bit of a different angle, and I'm going like, well, do you really need that? I'm not really sure.
Yeah,
so I'm not sure whether I like your French New Wave.
Take that, France.
No,
some of it's good, but it's an interesting style, and I think it's why it is so important is because it's doing something non-traditional and that kind of advanced advances it all along and whatever. But
what about the music? I want to talk about the music a bit because it's really interesting way to do music.
Yes.
We were talking through it during watching the film, and it's kind. We couldn't work out whether it was kind of diegetic or not.
I think you're right. I think it is theoretically diegetic, if
well,
that makes sense.
It's hard to say because sometimes you would have... There would be a sequence where people are driving and it would do, again, like this cut to them driving, you know, potentially a few minutes later and cut to them driving a few minutes later again, all in a sequence, but different kinds of music are fading in and out for a single shot that lasts for 3 seconds or so. Fade out, music fades out, picture fades out, fade out to a similar shot of them driving again with a different song.
Yes, which indicates time has passed, theoretically.
As if they're listening to a radio, right?
Yeah.
So that seems... That's diegetic.
Yeah.
But then there's other sequences where...
Like, the one that jumps to mind is like when Paulo is running around the city looking for Mark to kind of... kill him.
And it's the same thing again, but instead of cutting to cars driving, it's him
running the streets. Every time it's a different shot, there is a different song playing, which could either be the indication of time passing, or the idea of it being diegetic being that there is
music in cafes or music in bars
and restaurants kind of being pumped out
as he passes them.
Yeah.
But you're still left with this really weird... It's not bad. I wouldn't say it's bad. It's just very different.
Yes.
I've never seen that before. And it's a really strange way to decide. Like, it's a strange decision. Artistic decision to go, what we need is a series of shots of a person running, fade to black, cut to blah, 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 blah. But we'll also chop out the music here and there.
What I find interesting about it is it's very clearly going for a naturalistic style. Like, all the music is being presented as if it's being played in a restaurant or a radio or all of these kind of different avenues, yet it gives the film a really surrealistic quality, even though it's trying to be naturalistic, if you kind of follow that.
Well, I mean, I guess so. Because those make sense to me. Don't really understand why you would bother doing that diegetic way, but it still makes sense. Yeah, of course you're going to be listening to different kinds of music as you run past different restaurants or whatever, right?
But gives then it this otherworldly kind of bizarre feel, even though it's supposed to be kind of normal, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to put your finger on it.
Yeah,
and that's why I bring it up, because it's like this, it's a really strange thing.
Yeah, and it's similar as well. There are a couple of shots in the film where you like said out loud, like, was that necessary? Like, there's a few weird shots where it's just, like at right at the beginning, like, this street sweeper, like, there's about 3 or 4 times it goes around. You're like, is that... Do we really need to have so much coverage of, these certain scenes? You could just let him either trim it down or, like... But that's me... Like, my understanding is he's going for a naturalistic feel. He's just trying to make it seem very... real and true to life. That's why he's left in these little weird mundane moments.
Yeah, maybe. But then he's still like,
what's the
just
point?
Have a single shot though. Like, don't have it all cutting to the same thing but a different angle.
Apparently he was a like a Kubrick before Kubrick, in that he was a real perfectionist. And
So obviously, I mean, I know he obviously means to do what he's
doing. Yeah, but it's just
I just can't work it out. That's all,
because there's no... like, with Kubrick, you can definitely... It's very clear what that man is doing with each and every one of his films.
He's trying to upset you.
Yeah. Pretty much. How can I make the audience as uncomfortable as humanly possible? I know I'll have my... I'll have, fucking... What's his name from Clockwork Orange? Malcolm McDowell just stare into the lens without blinking for 2 minutes as I slowly pull out. Welcome to my world.
Yeah.
But it's... Yeah, it's... This film, though, it doesn't seem to be going... Like you were saying, it's a popcorn film. It doesn't seem to be having a grander message at its core that is reinforced by those odd little moments, I think.
Mm.
So they are just odd little moments for the sake of...
Well, they're... Yeah.
Odd little moments.
Yeah, but they're odd little film techniques.
Mm.
And so, for the viewer... you're watching a popcorny movie with really original slash
unique,
yes, unique film techniques going on around you.
Yeah,
and yeah, it just gives you, I don't know, it gave me a sense that I was trying to unpack the film when it, at its core, it's just, you know, you just got to watch it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, there's a little bit of combating nature to that.
I think it might also be because with a lot of the films, it's been a while since we've had a popcorn film to just kind of sit back and be like, oh, that was cool.
Well, I certainly don't expect a French New Wave or precursor French New Wave film from the 50s to be a popcorn movie. So,
yeah.
So I definitely wasn't going into something like that expecting it.
Yeah.
And certainly watching the first 30 minutes. It's
when it's a straight character study.
It's not a popcorn movie yet, so.
Yeah, it really has the feel. I don't know if you've ever seen Hard Eight. It's Paul Thomas Anderson's first movie.
Oh, yeah, I think I saw that
with,
ages ago. I can't remember.
Gwyneth Paltrow, John C. Reilly, and Philip Baker Hall. It's about a old gambler, con man, who takes a young guy under his wing, and it's Philip Baker Hall takes John C. Reilly under his wing.
Yeah.
It's somewhat redemption or kind of bizarre, pseudo redemption story. That's what I got a distinct feel like, oh shit, that's what this movie is, and this is obviously a huge influence on Hard Eight.
Mm.
That's what we're going to get. It's just going to be a former crime guy's character study.
Mm.
Nope.
No. I don't know. It's a good ride though. This is it's a pretty fucking good movie. What spine number is this?
150.
Okay, so we're still one away from a look back.
Yeah, you were saying it seems like forever since we've done a look back, so we'll be having to do that next week.
That's because we switched to the 2 week,
yes,
the fortnightly podcast. I'm sure that's the reason.
Mm.
So what else can we talk about? What other shit is there to talk about this movie?
I was going to say, like, the camera work and the lighting and everything. It's fine. I think in the beginning, it's definitely, as is the story and the narrative, it's a very noir-based, but then once the heist comes into it, that kind of slips away and you don't have the kind of dramatic lighting where it's like, you know, a dark room with, like, one light on. And it loses that kind of feel and it just becomes a movie at that point. It's not going for a tone or style piece. So, yeah, it's fine.
I stopped noticing.
Yeah.
At a certain point, I kind of got involved in the flow of the story, and I stopped noticing so much.
Yeah.
So.
Performances were great. I don't know, I'm just kind of throwing stuff out there.
I think Anne, the young lady Anne, was really good. She was really... She didn't actually have a lot of dialogue and a lot to go off, but she definitely had a strong presence there where she was kind of a strong
young
lady, very sassy, very sultry. And definitely, I got the impression that she can definitely sway the most hard-willed man. Mm. But she's always in the backdrop. She's some kind of trophy to some people. I couldn't really work out what Bob was doing with her as well. He wanted to kind of have her be around, not in the sense that he wanted to, like, you know, take advantage of her in any way, but...
It seemed somewhat like he wasn't interested in her for himself, he was interested in her for Paulo, which...
No, that's not true, because later on she asks if she can stay at his house again. He's like, not while Paulo likes you. Because he was bummed out that she left, man.
He
wanted her to stay with her, maybe in some kind of fatherly sense.
I guess. It's never really explored much because he establishes that he wants her to stay with him, and then, like, a day later she moves out and he's just like, ah, c'est la vie. Like, he doesn't seem too affected by it, so it is kind of...
Well, he's got a job to do.
He's got to go gamble.
Yeah.
I know, it's she was an odd character. Like you said, like the performance was top notch, and
she just just got a sense that she had held strong strong ideals of that weren't necessarily embedded in the dialogue, but it was kind of behind her eyes. She really wanted comfort and security and, you know, mountains of gold.
Yeah.
And adoration of men.
She was a weird one. Like, from the second she showed up, I think both of us made the comment, like, oh, she's going to be bad news. Like, she's going to... Something's going to happen. Like, and she's going to be the cause of it. And that... And she does nothing to give you that sense other than the way she carries herself, which is purely performance-based.
Mm. I like the lieutenant as well.
Yeah.
He was a funny one because he was also acting as a kind of father figure to Bob.
Yeah.
You know, like, he's like, man, I know you're doing the heist. Maybe just don't do it, man. I want you to be safe.
Yeah.
And it's a fucking weird angle for
you get the backstory of why that relationship exists, which is... I think nice. I don't think it's necessarily fatherly. I think it's friend based. Like, it's he's looking out for his friend.
No, that's true. He does literally say, like, I'm a friend.
Yeah, we became friends because Bob saved my life. So it's like it is just, I think, he's conflicted in the sense of, like, just I know you're a criminal, but just don't be though. Don't be a criminal.
I don't want you to be. I like you.
Yeah.
It
would suck if I would have to arrest you.
Yeah. So let's talk about the ending, because it's really bittersweet. I mean, it's a really weird ending. It's throwing you around quite a bit. You have a confrontation between all the fellas that are going to do the heist and the police, because obviously the police know that they're going to be doing the heist on the night that they're doing it, and everyone gets shot up, including Paulo.
Yes.
Who dies. I assume he dies.
Yes, yeah. Yes, he dies.
No, he definitely dies. And it's so weird because Bob grieves for a second, but then he's so carefree once he gets in the car and says, don't worry about it, I found millions of dollars.
I found that real odd as well. Like, especially since it's kind of been established that Paulo is, like, his facsimile son, and he's... The whole point is, like, he's looking out for him. But is it because he's coming off of the high of finally getting over his losing streak and being a successful gambler again? The high of that is kind of clouding the judgment of, I got Paulo shot.
Yeah.
I did it again.
Because he was so carefree. He's like, don't worry about it. I'll get a top lawyer. I'll be fine.
Yeah. Shit's all good. Make sure none of your sticky-fingered police steal my monies.
Yeah, that I won finally. I mean, that would be a hell of a high, I'm sure. But, yeah, Paulo's dead. Let's keep going. Yes.
Pouring myself a nice glass
of white.
A Pinot Grigio.
So, you know,
it,
that's a strange one.
Yeah.
I
think at that...
Is that highlighting Bob's nature, maybe? Because
I think that's what it's doing. Because that's...
It's all about the win for him.
Yes. Which at the end of the... And that's why it's all about the win and the gamble and that... What everything that goes along with that, which is why he... The narrator even says, like, he is so caught up in what he is doing that he loses track of time and forgets why he is there.
Mm.
And so he forgets to fucking call off the heist, which results... Like, it is that self-centered nature of the gambler and the self-destructive aspect of it, I guess.
But the film spends the whole film setting Bob up as a kind of lovable hoodlum.
Yeah.
But and then to put him in that light at the very end to say, like, yeah, he cares more about the win than he did Paulo is a bit of a shift in what the film was setting up.
And especially for it to then just go straight, like, a sarcastic remark, credits, you're like...
Yeah, yeah.
Is that the thing of, like, this character you've gone this entire film and you've kind of... lack of a better term, like, falling in love with. Like, you're following him on this journey and you care for him.
He's very charming,
isn't he? Yeah, to then just be like, oh, this guy's a dick.
Yeah, I mean, that comment about, don't worry, I'll get the top lawyer.
Yeah.
And it's like, I've got no worries in the world. Not even Paulo is getting me down right now.
Yeah, is it just this whole thing, the whole, like, misdirect of, like, oh.
You're a dick.
Oh, we shouldn't have cared about this guy, and we have. Which is a kind of bummer, but it's interesting, I guess.
There was one setup. Well, I thought it was a setup, but it turned out not to be a setup. Bob has a kind of... He's got a slot machine in his house, and he says that he's never won on it. And there's this one sequence right before he goes out to do the heist that he puts the coin in, and he's about to pull the slot machine... I don't know, I'm not a gambler. What do you call it?
The lever.
Yes, it's a lever of some description.
Yeah. The handle of the slot.
Yeah, the slot what? Handle. Very good. Very good.
The Jimmy?
Yeah, like... But then he decides, nah, fuck it. I don't need it, right?
It's because he'd made the promise to Roger, the guy, the safecracker, that he was not going to gamble until the heist was completed.
Oh, I was so expecting him to come home and go like, ah, fuck it, I'm a gambler, whatever.
Yeah.
And then have it win, finally. I thought that was a setup. It wasn't a setup.
Yeah, and it especially I thought that's where it was going to go once the unraveling of the heist starts to happen. You're like, oh, it's not actually going to end up being a heist, and it's all going to fall apart, and he's going to go home, and he's going to pull the lever and win and be like, oh, I'm not a criminal anymore. This is who and what I am, is a gambler.
Mm.
Credits. But it never kind of gets to that point.
Yeah, instead Polo dies.
Instead Polo dies, okay, he wins like $80 million, it's fine.
Yeah, it's all okay, because he can afford a top lawyer.
Yeah. He can afford a top lawyer, everyone else is fucked.
I know, it's such a crazy ending, man.
Ending, right?
I don't, like, it's kind of enjoyable.
Yeah,
it's really absurdist, almost. Like it's gone so long to set up a really solid character, and then to have that situation where...
Just be like...
I mean, you don't even know who shot first between the cops and the... And all of the, like, all of the, you know, his helpers.
Yeah.
Because you can't see muzzle flare, and...
You just actually present it's a cacophony of noise.
Well, the person... One of the helpers that may have shot first...
Yeah.
His gun is off frame, so you don't even know... Like, you can't even see a recoil.
Yeah.
So I don't know if the cops shot first, which case, like... You know. In which case, Bob's got nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
He can win all that money at the casino, and then...
I just waltzed outside, and all this was happening, and they arrested me. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
I know, it's... I did really enjoy this film. I think it's, It's so different from any other heist or gangster film I've seen for a very long time that
but yet so similar.
Yeah. It's an odd one, and I think it's gonna stick with me for a little bit.
Yeah, it's good.
Especially that whole just, like, taking the rug out from you on this character at the end. It's, I can't think of another filmmaker that does that. Like, not even Tarantino has the balls to do that.
It's a really strange tonal shift.
Yeah.
To have
the last shot of the film be like, yeah. No.
To have a really sad moment where Bob's cradling Paulo and then to, like,
it's the accepting of his wise fate
crack.
A wise crack and just like, I'm on easy street now. Like, yeah, no, I can't think of a filmmaker that has the balls to do that.
I don't know what to take from that.
Mm. Well, on that note, do you want to hear a little bit of trivia about the movie?
Sure thing.
Yeah, so the film was considered the precursor to the French New Wave, which started in 1959, as previously mentioned. Jean Cocteau did an uncredited rewrite of the script at one point for Jean-Pierre Melville. So Cocteau, you'd probably know Beauty and the Beast that we watched.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Fuck yeah. That movie is great.
Yep. Most of his script was rejected because it focused too much on Bob and Paolo's relationship rather than Melville's original intentions. So he kind of threw away with that. This is actually... Yeah, I already...
Well, yeah. Oh,
sorry.
So did he plan to make an even stronger tie between the two?
I think Melville read... Like, my take from that brief little thing is that Cocteau probably read the script... And was like, oh, this is a character study, because that's what the first third, if not half of them, the first half of the film is a character study. So he's like, well, let's just expand more on these characters. Whereas Melville's is like, no, I was using the character study to set up heist film. Mm. And that's never mind, don't worry, I don't need your shit.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so the film, it was filmed over a painstaking period of 2 years. This was Jean-Pierre Melville's attention to detail dragged out the shooting. Daniel Clouchy, who played Daniel Cochi, who played Polo, actually found the time to make another 4 films in the period it took to have this film shot and finished. Then the other kind of main one, I suppose, I found this one interesting. This film is a huge influence on The Transporter, the Jason Statham film, what? Apparently. The criminal and the cop relationship was directly influenced from this film, apparently. I have not seen The Transporter, so I can't really speak of to that, but I guess.
Yeah, that's so intriguing. I haven't seen that either, because it's The Transporter.
Yep.
That's very intriguing.
Stanley Kubrick once said in an interview that he gave up doing crime films because Jean-Pierre Melville did the greatest with Bob Le Flambeur. And Jacques Becker did the second best with Touche pas ne Grisby. He later directed A Clockwork Orange. However, he never considered it a crime film, a socio-political film instead.
Well, that's technically accurate.
So, yeah, Kubrick considers this the best crime film of all time.
What do you reckon is the best crime film of all time?
Me, personally?
Yeah. There's so many crime films.
There's so many crime films. Like, I mean, the first one that jumps to mind is, like, the very stereotypical answer of Goodfellas. But yeah. I think that's probably the best gangster movie, not necessarily crime. Because technically you could argue that 12 Angry Men is a crime film.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, so, yeah, it's a very... I don't know.
I don't know. I guess we'd have to define what crime is.
Yeah.
The crime genre of films.
Yeah, and then break that down as... Yeah, and then... I need to take a step back and look at my DVD collection.
It's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah. So Kubrick considered this to be the greatest crime film. This is the favourite gangster film of Quentin Tarantino. This is one of Jim Jarmusch's favourite movies, as well as as well as being the favourite film of Mike Hodges and Paul Thomas Anderson. So I wasn't far off with the... the hard eight influence that this film had.
Yeah, good on you.
Yeah.
That's fucking really good. That's a strong recommendation.
So it's two of the greatest living filmmakers and probably the greatest filmmaker, living or dead, consider this to be one of the best films ever made.
Is that Kubrick?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to debate him being like one of the best ever.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of interesting that this film is like put in such esteem from other filmmakers, and I think that has to do with the whole unique take on a very traditional genre.
Yeah,
the fact it's, which is what a lot of those filmmakers did and or are doing with their films. It's taking the idea of what a specific genre or a type of film is, and then growing or expanding upon it and creating it into something different.
Does the special features have any of the aforementioned directors, their thoughts on the film?
No.
Oh.
No. But I'm sure there's a... you could probably find some stuff out there.
Yeah, because I really like this movie.
It'd be interesting to see other people... especially
those fucking people, man.
Yeah.
Tarantino and Kubrick and P.T. Anderson and fucking, you know.
Hearing them and Jarmusch as well, hearing them discuss how much they love this movie would be real interesting.
Because we've raised a few, you know, perceived problems.
Yeah.
Subjective, of course.
Yeah.
But like they're not. They're not deal breakers.
No. It'll be interesting. I'll have a look around in the next kind of week or two and if I can find any interesting nuggets from those filmmakers talking specifically about this one, I'll chuck them up on Twitter and things, and hopefully we can get some info.
Okay.
But we'll move on to the actual Criterion edition itself. Unfortunately, the film is out of print from Criterion, but you can, you know, usually find a few copies floating around on eBay and whatnot. It's not one of the, like, ridiculously priced out-of-print ones, so... if you can find it, it comes with the special features of a video interview with Daniel Cochi, who played Paulo, a radio interview with Jean-Pierre Melville, as well as the theatrical trailer and the usual booklet and essays that Criterion always do.
Very nice.
Yeah. So, not much, but enough. it's something. It's not one of those editions that has just the trailer. It at least has some stuff.
It's not loaded, but it's juicy.
Yeah. But I guess unless you got anything else, that'll probably wrap us up for this week's episode.
I do not.
You do not. All right. Well, in that case, if you have any comments or queries or think we've missed anything, please send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com or feel free to follow us on Twitter at @CriterionQuest. Other than that, we will be back in a fortnight's time with a Steven Soderbergh film, coincidentally. Having talked a lot about Ocean's 11. His first film in the collection, we're going to go back and watch Traffic.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, the drug film. I haven't seen it in a very, probably, like, 8-10 years or something, so I'm very excited to revisit this movie.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, and
I haven't seen it in ages.
but yeah, thanks for listening. For this week's episode, I'm Chris.
I'm Tom. See you next time.